And at the end of that, we stroke our chins, pretend we've nothing to do about it, and ask how we are going to promote stability in the region. You have got to be joking.
EU energy ministers will meet again on the 13th of December to try and reach agreement on the vital question of 2023 gas supplies. Analysts say this crisis best illustrates how sanctions against Russia have backfired. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. The recent decision by Italy to close its ports to the Ocean Viking vessel carrying 234 refugees has been slated in the European Parliament. The vessel, operated by a charity, was eventually allowed to dock in France.
How cynical is it that NGOs filling this gap and saving lives are criminalised, whereas the states violating their obligation enjoy impunity?
Asylum applications have increased by 60% in the EU during the past 12 months. That figure is separate from those arriving from Ukraine. In fact, the 27 EU nations are providing maximum support to Ukrainians, while those from other countries are often forced to sleep on the streets.
How dare so many of you define yourself as Christians and repeat that you are defending Christian values when your ideas and your actions are proof of the opposite.
In the Mediterranean alone, 2,000 refugees have drowned so far this year, according to the International Organization for Migration. The message seems to be, if you're not one of the 4 million Ukrainians who have arrived in the EU in recent months, you're not welcome. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen and Libya. Apparently, the far right is flourishing in the EU due to the bloc's neglect of refugees.
How did Lega get big? How did the AfD get big? How did Marine Le Pen get big? It's all by capitalising on the fears of migration.
The ascent of the extreme right in the EU is certainly bad news for asylum seekers, according to analysts.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
EU Home Affairs ministers will hold an emergency meeting on the refugee crisis this Friday. There's a great deal of scepticism that anything will be achieved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Deal or no deal? While the EU is still reluctant to lay its negotiating cards on the table, at a press conference in the capital, Tehran, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stressed that Iran's negotiating team is ready for the next round of talks and is waiting for the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, to set a date for ministerial-level negotiations.
We have made our stance clear, and in the previous negotiations, we communicated our views regarding the remaining issues. Last week, we announced that we are ready for the next round of talks, and now Mr. Borrell is following up and trying to set a date. Obviously, talk will continue if we make sure that our logical demands are met.
In the words of Hossein Amir Abdollahian, resolving the remaining issues with the IAEA, receiving guarantees on the economic benefits of the deal for Iran, and removing unilateral sanctions are the three key issues that need to be worked out.
The JCPOA revival talks are high on the agenda, and we are adamantly following up on the issue. Of course, this will happen when we make sure that our reasonable demands in line with our national interests are met.
According to the top diplomat, Iran and the U.S. continue to exchange messages. However, American officials take what Amir Abdollahian calls a hypocritical stance while talking to mainstream media by making comments that contradict the messages that they send to Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has always deviated from its technical path and taken a political stance. European and American negotiators had promised that this would not happen again, but they broke their promise yet another time.
These comments come after a recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA Board of Governors prompted the Islamic Republic to announce that it will begin 60% uranium enrichment in its Fordo nuclear facility. Over the past couple of years, Iran has demonstrated in practice that it is committed to the JCPOA, or the nuclear deal. It has always been the other side that has neglected the agreement. Now, Iran says for these negotiations to reach a final conclusion, it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
On Tuesday, Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni unveiled Italy's 2023 draft budget bill during a press conference held at the government building. The package features a $35 billion spending plan and fiscal policies focusing mainly on supporting families, self-employed workers and those on low incomes.
Due grandi priorità.
There are two big priorities: growth, which means safeguarding our production system, and social justice, which means focusing on families and on people on low incomes. This budget is the product of political choices, as is normal for a political government.
About two-thirds of the 35 billion euro budget bill will be allocated to measures aimed at helping struggling families and businesses with the cost of living emergency. Power bills have skyrocketed amid the energy crisis sparked by the Ukraine war, while Italy's annual inflation rate was almost 12% in October, the highest level since March 1984.
Buying food, fuel, paying power bills, it's very difficult. We are struggling to make ends meet, and we expect this government to help us.
The government must ease tax pressure. We can't go on this way anymore. And the war in Ukraine should be stopped. All problems began with the conflict.
A flat tax rate on incomes of up to 85,000 euros for professionals and individual businesses is to be introduced, while the controversial citizenship wage basic income introduced by the Five Star Movement in 2018 is set to be reduced. Also, the pension system will be reformed to allow early retirement. The cabinet also discussed the 2013 Euratom directive, which deals with civilians being exposed to ionizing radiations. Euratom is the European Atomic Energy Community, which was set up in the late 50s to shape Europe's nuclear energy market. The draft budget bill will now be sent to Brussels for approval before it is passed. Max Civili, Rome.
People have gathered to receive winter fuel in form of coal and wood distributed by Iranian embassy in Kabul to warm the cold days of their lives. Najiba and Tahira, who take care of their children all alone, cry out the problems of the cold winter.
I don't have a supporter and my husband has passed away. It's five of us in my family, all of whom are jobless. Currently, we live in a rental house. We could really use such aids and hope it continues, especially in winters.
It is a hard winter, especially for us who don't have the primary needs of our lives. I have small children. I literally don't have anything to warm my home. I work hard to feed my seven family members, but still can't meet our needs.
Almost all who receive relief aids are widows and orphans, most of whom burn plastic, tires, and other waste materials to warm their houses and sometimes cook food. The happiness is noticeable as these widows can provide a warm home for their orphans. The number of these families can reach up to 1,000.
Well, we are prepared to distribute fuel to 1,000 families. The fuel is firewood and coal. We give each family a package of almost 200 kilograms. It isn't much, but it could be enough for almost a month. We are hoping to be able to continue such activities in the coming months also.
With the arrival of winter, concerns about the situation of the people of Afghanistan have intensified. The arrival of winter and warming houses has added to the daily problems of the poor in Afghanistan. Although aid is being provided to some people, there are still many who spend their nights in cold weather. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
four members of an Italian neo-Nazi organization known as the Order of Hagel were arrested on Tuesday in the cities of Naples, Caserta and Avellino, about 200 kilometers south of Rome. At different phases within the process of the investigation, the police collected numerous Nazi and fascist propaganda material, bullets, weapons, tactical clothing and other elements that convinced Italy's judiciary to make charges against members of the Order of Hagel. The police investigation was launched in 2019 when authorities suspected neo-Nazi groups were plotting violent acts in Italy. Today, members of the neo-Nazi organization, the Order of Hagel, have been accused of planning to carry out terrorist attacks on civilian and police targets.
Investigative activity showed that the neo-Nazi organization placed in Italy and Nazi-Ukrainian military groups, such as the Azov Battalion, Misanthropic Division and Centuria, have been in contact to conduct paramilitary training. In fact, diplomas were given for completing the training.
The Azov Battalion is a neo-Nazi paramilitary group that has been incorporated into the Ukrainian National Guard and is currently fighting against Russian troops. The Order of Hagel is an organization based in the area surrounding Naples. Authorities, however, suspect that the group may have subdivisions across Italy. The Order of Hagel has established operational ties to the Azov Battalion. Besides Nazism and anti-Semitism, it promotes subversion and white supremacy culture.
Some of the neo-Nazis' organization's members were trained in Ukrainian camps with the purpose of conducting the military operations in Italy. The group was recruiting among disadvantaged Italians, often young people, people who have a negative, incomplete view of society and can be easily manipulated. The Order of Hagel maintains direct and frequent contacts with its members over Telegram.
An additional member of the neo-Nazi Order of Hagel organization remains wanted by the Italian police, but is currently fighting Russian forces alongside the Azov Battalion. Not long ago, a high-ranking officer from the International Criminal Police Organization, Interpol, warned that the high availability of weapons during the current conflict in Ukraine will result in the proliferation of illicit arms in the post-conflict phase. Max Civili, Rome.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. in the limelight.
Saudis are hiding many stories about the situation of human rights in their country. According to reports, there are hundreds of political prisoners languishing in the dungeons of the Saudi kingdom, which Mohammed bin Salman does not wish the world to know about them. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International noted, while the Saudis are reveling in their team's freak victory over Argentina in Doha, Qatar, there is an even more important story that needs recounting. There are hundreds of political prisoners languishing in the dungeons of the medieval kingdom. The de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, may not wish the world know about them, but they must not be forgotten. Just as the Saudis were celebrating their victory on November 22nd, and not likely to be repeated, the date coincided with completion of the 10-year sentence of human rights activist Professor Mohammed Fahad Al-Qahtani. Yet, he has not been released. Instead, he has been moved to another prison, but his whereabouts are not known even to his family. Dr. Mohammed Al-Qahtani's prison term has expired, and he has not been released. Adel Al-Said, an activist with the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights, was quoted by Middle East Eye as saying, Al-Qahtani is a professor of economics and a political activist. His sin was that he was one of the founding members of the Saudi Civil and Political Rights Association, ACPRA. The organization has since been disbanded. Professor Al-Qahtani and co-founder of the organization, Abdullah Al-Hamid, were arrested in 2010. They were handed 10 and 11-year prison sentences, respectively. What was their crime? They were accused of breaking allegiance to the ruler, questioning the integrity of officials, seeking to disrupt security and inciting disorder, and instigating international organizations against the kingdom. These allegations are bizarre. Is allegiance to the ruler compulsory? As for the integrity of officials, one only need recall the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Saudi officials, on orders from MBS, not only murdered Khashoggi in cold blood, but also chopped his body. It is widely believed that the body was then dissolved in acid. It has never been recovered. Al-Qahtani's family was naturally looking forward to his release after he completed his sentence. His wife, however, altered human rights activists more than 20 days ago that the prison administration had prevented him from communicating and transferred him to another unknown location. In prison, Al-Qahtani was being harassed by other inmates. When he submitted a complaint to the prison authorities, Al-Qahtani was transferred to an unknown location, according to ESOHR. His fellow co-founder of ACPRA, Abdullah Al-Hamid, died in prison in 2020. He had suffered a stroke 2 weeks earlier, but was kept in detention despite being in a coma at the hospital. Several other founding members of ACRPA are also behind bars, including human rights lawyer Walid Abu Al-Khair and Muhammad Al-Bajadi. The latter was detained without charge or trial in 2018 and remains behind bars. Adel Al-Said of ECOHR said that Saudi Arabia was not releasing political prisoners even after they had served their prison term. These include Muhammad Al-Rabaya, Isa Al-Nokefi, two other activists who served their terms but have not been released, according to Said. While the Saudi regime has always been brutal towards those demanding basic rights, the campaign of oppression has intensified since the ascent of MBS to power. Scores of academics, human rights activists, lawyers, preachers, economists, and women's rights activists have been arrested and languish in prison. There is no codified law in Saudi Arabia. The whim of the presiding judge passes for law. Judges are notorious for pandering to MBS wishes. They know that any person who has been arrested has clearly run afoul of the Crown Prince. They are sentenced to harsh prison terms. Even lawyers defending clients have been sentenced to prison for the temerity of defending the accused. Such well-known figures as Salman al-Awda, Ali al-Omari, and Awad al-Gharni are facing execution. They did not kill anyone. They simply called for peace between fellow Muslims. The case of Sheikh Salman al-Awda is instructive. In September 2017, Sheikh Salman al-Awda had prayed for reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. This was soon after MBS cut off relations with its smaller neighbor and imposed harsh sanctions on it. In January 2021, MBS made up with Qatar and invited the emir, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad al-Thani, to Saudi Arabia. Relations have been fully restored. MBS even attended the opening ceremony of FIFA World Cup on November 20th and was warmly received by Sheikh Hamad. So, why is Sheikh Salman is still in prison and facing the death sentence? This is what Saudi Arabia, a society ruled by savages, is all about. According to Press TV, hawkish Republican Senator Tom Cotton has agreed with the Biden administration's decision to grant sovereign immunity to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman over journalist Jamal Khashoggi's 2018 murder. What the administration has touted this week is granting sovereign immunity to Mohammed bin Salman is in keeping with the practice of custom of lawsuits involving foreign heads of state, Cotton told Fox News recently, adding, "It would have been a major break if those customs did not grant that kind of immunity." The U.S. State Department recently gave bin Salman immunity from the lawsuit despite Joe Biden's earlier promise to hold the de facto Saudi ruler accountable for the crime. Citing its constitutional authority as well as customary international law, the State Department said, "Prime Minister bin Salman, as a sitting head of government, is immune. While in office, from the jurisdiction of the United States District Court, is in this suit." Amnesty International recently condemned the Biden administration and called the act a deep betrayal. Amnesty Secretary General Agnes Callamard said in a statement, "The U.S. government should hang its head in shame. This is nothing more than a sickening, total, deep betrayal. First, the evidence of the Crown Prince's involvement in Jamal Khashoggi's murder was disregarded by President Trump, then President Biden's first bump. It all suggests shady deals made throughout." The U.S. intelligence community previously concluded the killing of Khashoggi, a Saudi dissident, was ordered by the Crown Prince, but Cotton claimed other regimes had done worse and that Washington could not be too fastidious with its foreign partners. Cotton said on Fox News, "Saudi Arabia is far from the world's worst abuser of human rights. Look, If it didn't have allies and partners who don't always share our political systems or our cultural and social sensibilities, we wouldn't have any allies and partners, he said. Khashoggi, who was murdered and dismembered by a Saudi hit squad at the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul on October 2, 2018, used to be a vocal critic of the Saudi regime and the crown prince. According to reports, he was lured into the diplomatic mission under the pretext of being provided with papers for his wedding. He was suffocated and dismembered while his fiancée waited outside for him. Biden vowed during his presidential campaign to make Saudi Arabia a pariah following Khashoggi's killing, but he reversed course in July as he traveled to the country and gave a fist bump to Ben Salman. Fred Ryan, the publisher of the Washington Post, has blasted Biden for both the trip and the recent move to grant the crown prince immunity. Ryan wrote of Biden, "He is granting a license to kill to one of the world's most egregious human rights abusers." Cotton said that federal laws have changed to allow U.S. citizens to sue governments that sponsor terrorist attacks, but he pointed out those changes don't apply to the Khashoggi case. When you're talking about individuals who are at the head of a foreign government, it's been customary for decades to grant them immunity, Cotton said. So it would be a major break in another effort in the campaign to alienate and ostracize Saudi Arabia not to recognize this traditional kind of immunity, Cotton claimed. Later in the program, Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Mark Warner said he agreed with Cotton's claim, saying the reason why there was a grant of sovereign immunity even to leaders we don't like is as much to protect American leaders and American diplomats when they're posted abroad from being subject to Saudi Arabian law or South African law, Warner told Brim, adding, so this has been historical precedent. Saudi Arabia initially issued conflicting stories about Khashoggi's disappearance, but eventually said he had been killed in a rogue operation. Despite denials by Riyadh's regime, some Western governments and a spy agency said the crown prince had ordered the assassination, causing a global uproar.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The problem with America can only be resolved by letting that country hold us to ransom. That is the view of Iran's leader when it comes to negotiations between Iran and the West, particularly the U.S. Making those comments in an address to a group of Basij Force members, he also said or pointed to the enormous voice of the nation that rang out earlier this month during pro-government demonstrations, stressing that enemies are trying to dominate minds and influence the world public opinion through spreading lies and fake news. Just some of the topics we'll be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. But first, let me introduce our guests. Kevin Barrett joins us. He's an editor at Veterans Today who joins us from Madison. Also joining us is Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'd first start with you, Kevin Barrett. The Iran's leader's address was received and was done at a forum where it consisted of the besieged forces, which are affiliated with the country's Revolutionary Guards. At the same time, they have been at the forefront of dealing with this rioters. And the sacrifice made by them was something that Iran's leader applauded, saying, quote, "You saw in these recent matters that the people of besieged sacrificed themselves to prevent the nation from succumbing to the force of a group of what he called rebels who were illiterate or enslaved people. And they sacrificed themselves to prevent the cruelty of another." The important role that they played is something that is not highlighted in terms of preventing, obviously, these security breaches, to say the least. How do you view that those comments made by Iran's leader on the besieged forces?
Well, this is something that most people in the West don't know anything at all about, and they don't understand that there are many, many millions of people in the besieged forces who are dedicated to upholding the Iranian constitution that makes Iran the world's first Islamic republic. And this group it's got a lot of different facets. It's got social welfare elements. The besieged people are also running educational institutions and doing education and working on all kinds of interesting projects, infrastructure and so on. And then they also are a sort of line of defense of the Islamic Republic. And here in the West, where it's sort of taken for granted in the mainstream media, which is largely dominated by the Zionist enemies of Iran, that Americans are supposed to support some kind of regime change in Iran, it's not understood to what extent that there is this big, well-organized base of support for the ideals of the Islamic Republic. And it's also not really recognized to what extent the relatively marginal forces opposing the Islamic Republic are, in fact, guilty of treason. In the same way that here in the United States, if we had groups that were taking money and weapons from other countries to try to overthrow the Constitution of the United States of America and put an end to the United States as a democratic republican experiment and instead turn us into a monarchy or a dictatorship or what have you, I mean, that would be the highest form of treason. And likewise, these Iranians who are trying to undermine their Islamic Republic are traitors. And fortunately, they're in a small minority. And there's, of course, a broad segment of opinion in Iran that's just people trying to get by in life, just like everywhere else. But the besieged group is really they're the forces, the boots on the ground. They're the popular group that's mobilized in support of the revolution. And they're probably the single biggest impediment in the path of these regime change plans that are coming out of Washington.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what Iran's leader has said regarding the riots. Marcus Papadopoulos, he said some are telling us in the newspapers, on the internet, that in order to put an end to these troubles, all you need to do, which started a few weeks ago, he said all that is needed is to resolve your problem with America and listen to the voice of the nation. But he has come out and also said that negotiating will not resolve anything, and that resolving our problem with America can only be resolved by letting that country hold us to ransom. That ending statement there is what is being highlighted. What do you think the relevance of that is? What was he trying to say there, Iran's leader?
For the sake of Western audiences, let me say the following. Iran has been maligned, indeed demonized, by America for 43 years because ultimately in 1979, Iranians from all walks of life came together to liberate Iran from the yoke of American and British tyranny, which had, amongst other indignities, plundered Iran's national resources and had violated Iranian cultural and spiritual values. The problem in the West, specifically in America and in Britain, is that people in the aforementioned two countries view Iran through a Western prism, like how they view Israel through a Western prism. When I say to ordinary Westerners in person that Iranian soldiers helped to liberate Christian towns and villages in Syria from the control of either ISIS or Al-Qaeda, these people stare at me gormlessly. Indeed, no different to when I say to the average Westerner that during the conflict in Syria, the Israelis treated wounded Al-Qaeda fighters in Israeli hospitals. Again, the average Westerner whom I say that to looks at me in a gormless manner. So that really is a lesson in human psychology and demonstrates the extent to which the average person in the West has been brainwashed when it comes to Iran. Now, concerning the speech given today by Iran's supreme leader, yes, I agree with him. There is no reason as to why the Iranian government should sit down and negotiate with the Americans. It will not pay any dividends whatsoever. The most important thing for the Iranian government is to do what it has been doing for the last 43 years, developing Iran's economy, providing jobs and homes and salaries and pensions and a welfare state to the Iranian people, and of course increasing Iran's military capacity to protect the Islamic Republic. Other than that, as I said, there is no reason why the Iranian government should sit down with the Americans. After all, the Americans for 43 years have been posing a knife to the throat of the Iranian people.
Well, Iran's leader has said, Kevin Barrett, that, you know, if we were to look at the negotiations, these riots that have occurred in the country is part of the pressure campaign that the West wants to Iran to compromise on a variety of issues when it comes to the negotiations. And he talked about some of which there are some deadlocked topics. For example, the U.S. wants Iran to abandon its nuclear program, change its constitution, restrict its influence to inside its borders, and to close its defense industries. So you're pretty much stripping a nation out of everything. And he says even if that's done, it's going to keep going into different demands and wanting different concessions from Iran. So pretty much saying that, you know, negotiating with the West is really not appropriate. How do you view that approach by Iran's leader? Do you agree with it?
Yes, I think the leader is right. Just as he was right in the past when he expressed skepticism about the JCPOA when it was being negotiated, he did allow the negotiators to make their best faith effort to reach an agreement, but he never really had faith that that was going to solve the problem. And that viewpoint was borne out by subsequent events after Trump tore up the JCPOA, completely shredded it and violated it. That showed that the leader's skepticism had been warranted. And today, of course, even stronger skepticism is even better warranted. We're seeing this regime change effort against Iran as the West, well, specifically Washington and Tel Aviv, with some help from London, are mobilizing every kind of force they possibly can to attack Iran through every means other than a declared war. You know, they're arming, you know, paid separatists and terrorists. You know, they've already been arming terrorists for a long time. You know, 17,000 Iranians have been murdered by these terrorists, especially the MEK, which is now a fully West-supported, Washington-supported group. But now they've really gone all out. And then these demands, of course, are ridiculous. Obviously, Iran is not going to completely disarm and not have any kinds of relationships with its allies in the region. That's ridiculous. Iran is the largest and, it shares with Turkey, I guess, the status of really the largest and most potentially important sort of geopolitical entity in the region. And because Iran is fully independent and sovereign, unlike Turkey, which is still, it's working at it, but it isn't quite there yet, Iran has a huge role to play. And this notion that Iran is going to just fold up its tent and sort of disappear is completely absurd. So the leader is absolutely right. There's no point in negotiating with these lunatics who are mounting this unsuccessful attempt to overthrow your country and overthrow your constitution through violence and terrorism and lies. So you just have to outlast them. And that strategy has worked so far, and it should work even better as we reach the end of the unipolar American empire and the rise of a new multipolar world that Iran will play a very important part in.
Marcus Papadopoulos, you talked about the way that the West views Iranians and Iran as a whole. And also, I believe you touched about that being a result of the way that the media has actually played a hand in that. Now, one thing that really stood out in this media landscape is what happened yesterday when we take a look at the win that Iran's team had against Wales, where you had these Saudi-funded, for example, TV station or a media channel by the name of Iran International, where they were demanding Iranians not to celebrate. They said you should not celebrate. They were telling them what to do, in other words, and that this was wrong, what happened. Of course, critiquing the Iranian soccer players and the team for participating in the World Cup, they even went as far as that. But the mere fact that they're demanding Iranians showed the true face of their, in a sense, as the word or the phrase has been thrown about, sinister plot by them in order to try to nail their version of how things should be. Doesn't that just reveal how low they have come in terms of trying to push their ideologies onto Iranians?
Well, as an overview, football, like other sports, is now in the vanguard of Western foreign policy. The World Cup is being used by the Western ruling elites to push for changes in countries such as Iran, countries which pursue an independent foreign policy and which do not bow down to the diktats of Washington. That is how sad the situation is, that the Western ruling elites have politicized sports. They have politicized the Olympics. Indeed, let me go one step further. The Western ruling elites have weaponized the World Cup, and they have weaponized the Olympics. The BBC football commentators were referring to the Iranian national football team as the, quote, regime's football team. And after the match between Iran and Wales, BBC journalists were attempting to ask political questions to Iranian national football players. Politics and sports, as any level-headed person would know, should be kept absolutely separate. But as I said moments ago, sports is now in the vanguard of Western foreign policy. But if we apply the logic of the BBC, who are attempting to ask political questions to Iranian football players, then why were American sports people and British sports people not asked political questions by the BBC or CNN or the Daily Telegraph or Channel 4 News about Britain and America's war against Serbia, or Britain and America's invasion of Iraq, or Britain and America's support of terrorists in Syria? Because if you're going to ask Iranian football players such questions, then of course the logic should be applied to British sports people and American sports people. And for the record, I do not believe that British sports people or American sports people should be subjected to political questioning. Indeed. But again, it shows the sheer how low the Western ruling elites have fallen to when it comes to persecuting Iran. And let's be very clear about it. Iran and the Iranian people are being persecuted by the West.
Well, the West is also not covering the news, if they were to be impartial, which they're not, Kevin Barrett, when it comes to an issue like the pro-government rallies that took place. We saw that it was in the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, that showed up when there was, for example, security personnel that were martyred in Isfahan, for example, or when you had the former spy den, as we call it, of the former U.S. embassy, which we refer to as the spying den, of which you saw hundreds of thousands of people, not just showing up here in the capital, but around Iran. Those types of protests where there was a large presence was not covered by the media. In particular, of course, either the Saudi-funded news channel or the state-funded, UK state-funded BBC. Again, this is part of that shaping the image in a different way by the media. How would you rate their efficiency if that was their goal?
I think the Western media has discredited itself to a great extent with its increasingly biased and tendentious coverage of so many issues, including these issues that are of special importance to the Zionist masters of Western media, such as trying to neuter Iran, which is the last major country that's standing up for the Palestinians. And so the Western media already has shot itself in the foot so many times that it lost the power to prevent someone like Donald Trump from becoming president. Now, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump by any means, but it's interesting that he won the U.S. presidency in 2016 by attacking the mainstream media. And the reason that that worked for the first time in American history, prior to that, whenever the media went all out against anybody, they were finished. That happened to so many candidates for so many offices, including presidential offices, but it doesn't work anymore because so many Americans have awakened to the fact that mainstream media is dubious. So by going too far on these kinds of issues, I think that they are undermining their own credibility. And although the sort of rough agreement with these kinds of perspectives that they put out there in these kind of sneaky ways that sort of unconsciously infiltrate the minds of the viewers is it's still somewhat effective in terms of creating a general vague impression of what's going on. What they end up doing is manufacturing support that is proverbially a mile wide but an inch deep. And this coverage of the World Cup and that these, you know, it has been so anti-Islam, right? Hating on Muslim countries that have Muslim values that don't allow for hooligans to get drunk in the streets and beat people up, and that don't allow people to celebrate bizarre sexual and gender ideas. This kind of all-out propaganda that we're seeing, including against Iran, by completely suppressing coverage of these massive demonstrations, mourning the people that have been killed by these terrorists who are trying to overthrow the government of Iran, and on the contrary, on the other side, things grossly exaggerating the people, you know, the size of the group of people that is working against Iran. All this kind of propaganda does in the long run is undermine the credibility of the media itself.
Sure. Israel, as Iran's leader referred to there, Marcus Papadopoulos, the usurper Israeli regime, is something that he said is in line with policies by the West, particularly the U.S., to have domination over the West Asia region in particular. And the question that I have is that has been in overdrive, and it's been like that for quite some time, vilifying Iran, creating Iranophobia, especially within the regional countries. We know that the U.S. has pushed Persian Gulf Arab countries to normalize ties with Israel, and they're vilifying Iran in order to have that unity and include and for Israel to be part of that. Of course, it's not really been that effective in a matter of speaking because not all have agreed to it. But do you think that's something that is working or that is not working to the way that they want it to?
Well, Israel is the main conduit for American power in West Asia. So one is not surprised whatsoever that Israel is one of the leading countries in attempting to overthrow the Iranian government and return Iran to how it was prior to 1979, namely a vassal state of the West. But I do believe that Iran is experiencing an increase in attempts by outside forces to weaken it, to subvert it, and to destroy it. And I am of the firm opinion that that is on account of Iran having a strategic partnership with Russia, and also on account of the war in Ukraine. Because the West, via NATO, is waging a proxy war against the Russian Federation. And Iran is a firm supporter of Russia and has shown sympathy for Russia's reasons for having militarily intervened in Ukraine. So it follows, therefore, that the West, in an attempt to weaken Russia in Ukraine, is attempting to weaken Iran at home, with the objective being as follows. If the Iranian government is overthrown and replaced by a pro-Western puppet one in Tehran, then Russia will lose a friend and ally of immense value, which can only weaken its position both at home in Russia and also in Ukraine. Uh-huh. That is why I believe there is an increased effort at present by the West and its regional allies in West Asia, including Israel and Saudi Arabia, to weaken Iran.
Do you agree with that, Barry Grossman?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Kevin
absolutely.
Barrett. Sorry about that. Kevin Barrett.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's obvious that the U.S. has chosen to try to fight Russia, Iran, and China all at the same time, which from an American imperial perspective probably isn't a very good strategy. Normally, you try to divide and conquer. So we, you know, the American empire should be trying to be friendly with one of those three, at least, while beating up on the other two, or better yet, be friendly with two while beating up on one. But they're so arrogant that they think that they can attack all three countries at once. And obviously, the Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians are not interested in being defeated and are going to be working together to prevent any one of them from being defeated. So the U.S. has driven these three critically important centers of resistance to the unipolar hegemonic world order together and turned them into a de facto alliance. And the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, has gotten stronger and stronger. And interestingly, this whole proxy war on Iran that we're seeing now developed. It actually began the day after Iran joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Obviously, that is not a coincidence.
Very well. We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Kevin Barrett there, editor at Veterans Today from Madison. Thank you for your contribution. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political.